The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session for Senate to adjourn.
Good morning. Be seated, please. First case in our calendar is 96-1376, State of Ohio versus Andrew McDennis. Mr. Ray.
Good morning. My name is Nick Ray. I'm attorney Peter. Your Honor, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of time.
Watch your time there.
What I'd like to do, Your Honor, is focus on two issues this morning that the other issue of course is addressed. I would be happy to do so. However, two issues that I'd like to focus on this morning are assignments of error number 5 and number 19. Five deals with the Gerald Harris issue with the initiative, and I'll move down in detail. The other one deals with the mitigation. Hearing in this case, what I will do is tie them both in together. What had happened in this case, over even 100 several facts, but what happened, there was a juror who sat in this case who failed to notify counsel in this case that she was a victim of a sexual abuse rape case. She failed to notify counsel during voir dire in this case, and in fact, this issue didn't arise until the sentencing phase of this case when the jury was out deliberating the death penalty in this case. My concern with her failure or non-disclosure in this case was a review of the record in this case. Whenever other jurors were asked about previous crimes that had happened to them that had indicated in the brief, there were a number of other jurors around her saying, this happened to me. As a matter of fact, one of the jurors who indicated that she had been raped herself was excused as an uncontroverted challenge by defense counsel. This never came to light to defense counsel during the course of the trial until we get to the sentencing phase. At that point in time, a detective from the Summit County, I think some kind of sheriff's or detectives there in Akron, approached the prosecutor's office and said, hey, one of the jurors on your case is a victim of a crime. We need her to come and sign some complaint stating that she's going to see the charges in this case. At that point in time, there was a voir dire or an interview of the juror by the judge and defense counsel.
Just for the purposes of accuracy, you keep saying rape, and your brief did also. Was this really rape? You know, there may not be much of a distinction to those people who suffer it, but wasn't it sexual abuse or gross sexual imposition rather than rape?
Your Honor, you're perfectly correct. My understanding is, and I don't know whether the record ever made perfectly clear, but the record did speak to gross sexual imposition. And as an attorney, I can say just made it gross sexual imposition.
But they're clearly different.
Yes, Your Honor. However, as I'm sure this court is aware, whether it's a gross sexual imposition or whether it's rape, what different degrees of felonies and crimes are still very traumatic experiences for the victim as they come up.
Counsel, when I went back and looked at the questions that were actually asked the juror to see how the prosecution had phrased them, and the first one was, did you have someone who was in a murder case or murder charges? The second one was involved in a robbery. And then the only generic question that he saw along those lines was that if you were sitting here instead of somebody else, would you want to be a juror? They never asked a generic question about any crimes or any. It was always murder, robbery. It was always a little bit violent thing. Now, people may volunteer things, but nobody asked, no prosecutor nor did defense counsel ask a specific, have you been a victim of any crime at all? How do you get around that? That she was simply answering as she testified in the hearing, I examined it, I didn't think it was a violent crime, so I didn't answer because it was not asked.
I appreciate that, and you're right, there was not a specific question, were you a victim of a crime, it was more of a murder or robbery, that sort of thing. Two things, number one, as an attorney, I've never represented anybody that didn't think that gross sexual imposition was not a crime of violence. Secondly, based upon the record around this this juror Harris, everybody was coming forward with things that happened. Number one, with murder. Number two, with robberies. Number three, with rapes. And then we get into more generic things. People were testifying, indicating in the jury selection process as to their car had been broken 10 years previously, their house had been robbed 10 years previously. All these,
How does somebody else just simply volunteering beyond what a question asked for impose some similar duty upon her?
I think at that point in time, Your Honor, I think there should have been an indication by this person that, look, everybody around me is coming forth and disclosing to the prosecutor, to the judge, to the court, to the defense counsel, what it is that's happened to them in the past. And I guess my concern in this case as a defense attorney is that this is something that she had maybe happened in the past. This was something that she was reliving right now. And this was something that I think that based upon questions, based upon the answers that were being given, I think that she should have realized that this is something that's important, especially whenever you have a detective coming into the jury room, or not one jury room, coming to the prosecutor during sentencing, and the death penalty case and saying, we need this person to come and sign a complaint for sexual possession. That's something that I think that an individual who's sitting there and listening to all these people answer their questions, they would say, you know, maybe this is important. And I think that based upon that, she should have disclosed at that point in time what had happened to her. Unfortunately, she didn't.
Is it accurate that counsel on both sides knew of this circumstance before trial? The court didn't learn of it until the penalty phase deliberations. But there is a reference in the briefs to the fact that, or in the record, that counsel was aware of this before the trial began. I'm going to the issue of waiver.
Sure. My understanding, Your Honor, based upon, and I will agree that this is not really clearly set out in the transcript, and it's kind of hard to follow. My understanding of my reading of the transcript is what happened, possibly at the time the jury selection had begun, the prosecutor thought or was made aware that Juror Harris was possibly a witness in a case. He disclosed that to Attorney Whitney, who was trial counsel for the defense. They never became aware that she was actually the victim in a case, or the victim and was going to sign a complaint saying, yes, I am the victim of a sexual position, until after they had already went into the decision with regard to the death penalty in the mitigation phase. And that's when they became aware that she was indeed a victim of her.
Did the judge actually allow the detective to pull her out and have a sign?
I have no idea. From the record, it's unclear. I can't say to the court whether that happened or not.
Wasn't the detective thinking about some consequences that might involve?
Obviously, at the time he wasn't, because he went to the prosecutor based upon the prosecutor's representation of the record and said, hey, get this juror person out of here. The reason it came up was because the juror Harris had two other sisters who was going to be signed to complaint along with her. And that's why they were going to have them all come in that evening. The jury was still in the deliberations and penalty phase. And at that time, the detective went to the prosecutor and said, hey, you want to see this person?
We know it's gross sexual position. Do we have any description in the record or otherwise of what constitutes that? I mean, it could have been something as simple as a touching of the breast, which, if you read her explanation in the hearing, you know, I examined myself, I didn't consider it a violent crime. I mean, I could see that lead being much more simple. In fact, the judge buys that, the defense attorney buys that. He doesn't raise an objection at the hearing and say, I want her out here. He doesn't do it at all at that point.
That's correct. There's no indication from the record of the house of your instance. I mean, it could have been as simple as a sexual position. It could have been serious as if it was a rape charge. We don't know that from the record. The problem is, only Juror Harris knows. She didn't disclose it. She never gave it.
But wouldn't that be material to whether she really should have disclosed it, since that specific question was not asked and it would have to be a quote volunteer thing? I mean, her basis is it wasn't a violent act, and you were asking about violent acts, and so I didn't disclose it. I mean, if that's the issue, then shouldn't we see how violent an act may or may not have been, even though we legally consider it a violent act?
Obviously, the question you're asking me is whether or not it's a post-conviction issue. I mean, obviously, you're exceeding the scope of the record and you're going into other areas. My problem with this case, this court here this morning, Your Honor, is that assume that, that this was just a mere touching or something like that. As the court has recognized, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, whenever you're dealing with a death sentence in a case, it needs a higher indicia of reliability. And in this case, I think that reliability is severely tainted by what we don't know.
Okay, counsel. It seems to me we're piling this thing up and trying to inflate its status vis-a-vis the evidence against your client, which was overwhelming. Confess? Did he not?
Yes, sir.
He fired a shotgun, point-blank range, accidentally, was his claim, right? But he had accidentally discharged the shotgun, what, two or three other times that evening? It's a pretty overwhelming case against your client, isn't it?
I don't think that the issue goes to, and I'm just trying to follow you on here.
Yeah.
I think this issue goes to the weight of the evidence in this case. I think it goes to whether or not that in this case we can say that Jeremy Dennis had an impartial or an indifferent jury, as the Sixth Amendment requires.
It might come into play in sentencing, but on the guilt phase, it's hard for me to comprehend how this incident that we don't know much about potentially tipped the scales against your client.
Well, I guess another way of approaching this, Your Honor, is once again, as you indicated, that there was a good deal of evidence in this case against Mr. Dennis. However, there also was, I believe, a voluntary instruction given in this case, a voluntary murder instruction given in this case, which was a possible consideration of the jury. Obviously, they chose to ignore that. We don't know weight consideration. And I think for me, at least, an important factor is that Mr. Harris was the foreperson of the jury. Obviously, the jury looked at her and said, hey, we're going to give you some more consideration than others because we're going to put you in a position of authority on this jury. I mean, to a certain degree, I think whenever an individual is placed as a poor person, they're placed in a position of responsibility. And that's one of the concerns that we have in this case here.
There was a, in chambers, the examination of Juror Harris about the incident and the court. I mean, she did then say, despite that, here's why I didn't answer, which was meant to eliminate the belief that she was intentionally holding this information. And so she gave an explanation. Counsel for both sides heard it, the court heard it. Then she also, I apparently, affirmed that she indeed would be able to separate this and this wouldn't affect her judgment.
That's correct.
And no one moved for the mistrial then, right? Counsel waited later to move for mistrial. And that's what we're looking at here, is error, and what's the standard of review for that sort of error,
well,
that sort of claim?
I guess that there's a number of different ways to go with this, Your Honor. The problem that I think the defense counsel had was that they didn't know about it until after they were in the sentencing phase. So at that point in time, they couldn't do a peremptory challenge for cause, they didn't have that option. The only thing they could do was request a mistrial,
right,
which they did.
Do you know the standard of review for that?
Well, obviously, I think what the court's probably going to be looking at is whether or not there was a manifest error on the part of the trial court in her decision in denying the motion for the mistrial.
It's not a discretionary call. You think it's an error? Review for error?
I think this is very reviewable for error, Your Honor. My guidance for that is decisions out of the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of this court in July. In Zerka versus Green, which this court relied on the state versus Williams, which came out a couple weeks ago. Zerka versus Green relied on a United States Supreme Court decision where the U.S. Supreme Court said if you have a problem such as this, if you can show that the juror failed to answer material questions, and that would have led to a challenge for cause, then you have reversible error. And that's my understanding of the Supreme Court's decision. I think in this case,
we don't have that. That's not what we have here. We have a motion for mistrial. And I guess, as Justice Stratton points out, you don't really have a refusal to answer truthfully a question. What you have is the juror not volunteering in a scenario where you think a volunteering was appropriate.
I think in this situation, you have failure to disclose the material element and the material element of the assembly whenever he was, oh, she had been in a professional position. As the defense counsel noted, when they asked the question of the motion for this trial, they never had the opportunity to use ask for cause on this individual to use motion for cause whenever they were doing the jury selection.
Can this be a harmless error in light of the fact that this case, would it be material that this case doesn't involve a sexual crime? Can this be harmless error?
I don't think it can be based upon that. No.
Based on which?
Based upon the jury's indication that this was a sexual crime as opposed to an act of murder that was given.
Is that one of the factors the trial court could have evaluated?
I don't think it was a factor to be evaluated.
But you say it's not discretionary to call me.
I think that's what we're up against is whether it's abuse of discretion. Like trial court, it's an open mistrial pressure on that person.
Counsel, must an attorney ask for a mistrial or bring things to the court's attention or object or whatever you want for the record when they first are informed of a possible problem, or can they sit and wait until the end of the trial and then, as in this case, ask for a mistrial? Wasn't there a waiver and that they were still in chambers and they both said, well, I guess we don't really have to do anything about this. I thought there was some sort of conversation that all the parties agreed that, well, it doesn't seem like we have to do anything about this now. And then they continued, and then, you know, at the end, then the motion for mistrial was made. Do you think that there was a waiver there?
Well, I would agree with the court that there was not a temporary objection at the time that they were in chambers and the motion for mistrial was made.
And nothing really came to light that made it more evident or obvious, right? After that, did it? I mean, they had all the facts then as well at the end of the trial, right?
They did, Your Honor. That's correct. However, I think at the point of the proceedings that they were in, that the motion for mistrial would have been relevant at any point in time. I mean, they were asked to state whether they could have objected for cause, they could have objected to use a peremptory challenge, they could have done anything. They were in the sentencing phase of the trial. The other juror, the alternative juror in this case, had already been dismissed. So the only alternative was to request a mistrial. They couldn't. That was it. I mean, and whether they did it at the time they were in chambers or whether they did it after the jury had returned to court.
So you feel there's no difference at when they would ask for the mistrial, just so they did sometime during the proceeding?
I think they deserve the record of the station honor by requesting a mistrial. Yes. If I could very briefly, I'd like to discuss Simon of Error 19, and that deals with the appropriate justice in this case.
Can we go to Simon of Error 12 before we, propositional law 12, before we do that? I just want to be sure that we don't write this into the law, and that my understanding is correct. It's with regard to the Allen charge, and I wrote State v. Howard that proposed a supplemental charge in these situations. Is it too strong to say, as you do on page 55 of your brief, this court set forth the proper instruction which a trial court must give to a jury when the jury indicates a unanimous verdict cannot be reached? That sounds like it was mandatory in State v. Howard, and I looked at it again because I was very careful, we were very careful, I think, not to make it a rote recitation of what we put in the syllabus in that case. That's the preferred. Isn't it too strong to say that it must be given?
Obviously, Your Honor, you've got one up on me because you wrote it and I just read it. My understanding...
And there's a world of difference usually sometimes.
So I guess I'm just going by my own interpretation.
All right. Is your interpretation of State v. Howard that that's a mandatory instruction in these situations?
My interpretation, Your Honor, and that's why I use the word language must, that it is applicable in all situations. I mean, that otherwise you leave it up to the discretion of the trial court, what we're going to use it, we're not going to use it, and then fall back to a situation where it doesn't really apply because of the discretion of the trial court. and I think that's why this court said, look, this is the law we're going to follow. And the law is, you come to a situation where you have a jury that says, we can't decide, we'll vote four times, we can't be so quite able to come up with a unanimous decision. They need some guidance, they need some instruction, and that's why this court came out with power to say, this is how it is, but I am using the court the last time.
Okay, well, we use such language in there that it is preferable, that this is an alternative, that, but it could not be like an Allen charge. And that's why I was wondering if you had construed it too strongly.
I
understand now, thank you.
Very briefly, with regards to Assignment Number 19, Proposition Law 19, Your Honor, which presented at the trial court.
So one other thing before you go on, because I want to finish that issue with the juror. You cite, or cited to us, trial transcript pages 1511 to 1512 on the issue of whether or not counsel knew prior to trial whether they were aware that Harris had been a victim of sexual abuse.
That's correct.
Did you check the record to see if that volume that you cite is part of the record? I can't find that volume. And your proposition of law with regard to the juror and the being a victim of crime and not disclosing it. It's important to me if you all knew before trial, or if the trial counsel knew before trial, and the memorandums we have and what I've been able to find indicates that both counsel knew that, not just as you say, that she was to be a witness in such a case, but that in fact she had been a victim of sexual abuse. That's a major difference, I think.
Yes, there is. If the court will look at the transcript pages 1511, 1513, that sets out for the court what the attorneys knew prior to trial. And that's the transcript.
And that's the pages that I'm citing you, 15, 11, 12, and 13. And I just sent out from that, the note came back. That volume appears to be missing from the record. You have it? Good. Would you read that? Is it there?
The record shows that they knew of her as a potential witness only, and not as a victim.
As a potential witness.
That's what the prosecutor shared with the defense counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Further on?
Nope, that supports your position. Thank you.
Very briefly, once again, with regards to Proposition Law 19, there were a number of mitigating factors set forth in trial. Number one was the defendant's age. The time of examining during the minutes was 18 years old. The second factor was the lack of criminal history. As the court is aware, the stipulation trials, he had a prior felony or a record. He did have a juvenile record for two nonviolent offenses, criminal damage, and received stolen property. The third factor that came in is other evidence or other factors for jury consideration to consider. As far as the director reviewing the transcript, in this case, there was testimony that came in about his background, his lack of guidance. Dr. Nathan Brown testified that he was in a social personality disorder, I believe. He tested with regards to his abilities. He was in the 99% of the population, or 1% of the population. 99% tested higher than he did for certain areas. That's all part of the mitigation that came in. One of the things the jury can have to consider, I think it's worth considering in the appropriateness of the essence in this case, is juror Harris. Obviously, we can't say that this was something that's reversible error. We say, hey, maybe in this case, this young man doesn't deserve to die because of the fact that we can look at Jerry Harris. We don't know what she was thinking. She was in that jury. She voted for death in this case. I think that the record has established that there were four prior votes that we went to come up with a unanimous verdict. I think that in this case, because we do have that information, that's a fact that this court can and should consider determining whether the state will be sentenced.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Merrick.
Okay, please report. My name is Paul Michael Merrick. I represent the state of Ohio at Appalachia in today's case. There are two issues presented by our council today. The first issue is that Juror Harrison properly kept part of the jury by the trial judge in the incident case. The state will offer two arguments in support of our position. The first argument is the defendant did, in fact, waive this assignment of error, this proposition of law. At the time that this issue arose, the defense counsel did not make an objection to keeping Juror Harris part of the jury. And in State versus Greer, this court noted that in capital cases, the doctrine of waiver would still properly apply. And in this case, there wasn't a timely objection made. That is especially noteworthy when one considers that the state immediately notified defense counsel that Juror Harris was a victim of a crime, and the defense counsel notified the trial judge to arrange this individual voir dire of Juror Harris. And after sitting through now two separate defense counsel voiced to hear what Juror Harris had to say on the matter, thinking that perhaps this juror was prejudiced, but biased, they sat through that individual voir dire, and neither defense counsel made an objection at that time.
Let me ask you, counsel, the right to a jury trial, a case such as this, as we know, is a constitutional right, and it's a right to a fair and impartial panel of peers, jurors. Is there a special responsibility in a trial judge to be sure that that if the lawyers miss something, miss an objection, that the trial judge should be sure that the defendant has a fair and impartial jury? Does this go beyond a ruling on evidence or a ruling on challenge for cause where a juror may have had some experience, not an experience such as this, a criminal act? What's the test in a situation such as this?
Yes, Your Honor, the trial judge does have special responsibility, statutory responsibility under Revised Code 23-13-43 to examine jurors who are challenged as having some prejudice. And the trial court did, in fact, call the juror Harris, did examine them individually, examine her in an individual voir dire with counsel present, and attempted to satisfy that duty on the part of the trial court. The state would agree that the trial court did have a mean duty in that regard. The state would respectfully assert that the defendant's failure to object is not so much counsel missing something, rather that is another factual indicia that this juror was not an interesting juror. This juror could, in fact, fairly administer her duties as a juror, and it wasn't a case of defense counsel missing something, because after all, they brought it to attention of the trial judge.
Prior to trial, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney knew that this juror was at least a prospective witness in a case. Were there any questions asked of this juror regarding what type of a case? You would think those would be natural questions. Were there any asked by either the prosecutor or defense counsel?
No, Your Honor, there were no such questions asked. And the initial voir dire before the trial formally began was an opportunity for defense counsel to voir dire simply on the information that we have.
Did the court ask questions and then allow defense counsel to ask questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
And no general questions about have you had any involvement in court proceedings and none like that?
No, Your Honor. Now, moving to the second point, Your Honor, is under 23-13.43, the trial court is charged with the responsibility of evaluating whether an individual juror that's challenged is prejudicial, can administer their duties in a fair and impartial manner. In this case, the trial court certainly did. In the presence of the state and defense counsel, an individual voir dire occurred, and Juror Harris unequivocally stated repeatedly that this would not encumber her in any way, that this would not make her partial. She described the incidents that she suffered as apples and oranges in this case. It did not make her more partial to the victim's family. She viewed this as a totally unique matter. And as has been stated, neither defense counsel saw fit to object at that time, presumably because the argument, as the trial judge was, that this juror was impartial and could complete her duties. And the trial court concluded before allowing juror Harris to remain as part of the jury, the trial court did take a moment to explain her rationale and stated that she was satisfied with the answer, that juror Harris was forthright in all her responses, and after all, she was there to examine juror Harris in the class to see whether she was evasive. Just giving pat rote answers, no, I can administer fairly. She saw the person in the flesh and resolved that she could administer it fairly. The trial court also noted that juror Harris, during the time of the initial voir dire, contacted court personnel in the form of the bailiff and asked, you know, is my experience a crime of violence? And at that time, there was some advice from the bailiff that, well, I think the crime of violence we're talking about here is murder or robbery or whatever, things of that sort. And at that point, juror Harris was satisfied that she needed to disclose the crime that she suffered at an earlier time. So juror Harris was conscientious and approaching some member of the court, some personnel of the court, and asking, you know, does that question that was asked to me, does that implicate my situation?
Counsel, what do you know about the underlying nature of the incident about that juror?
Your Honor, my understanding of it is confined to the record, as the appellant's counsel is, that her father had committed some acts of sexual abuse when she was younger, and that because of some disclosures of her sister's, I should say, there was some preparation of a formal complaint.
So this was something that had occurred back in time?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, turning to an issue that was raised by this court about State versus Howard, the charge described in Howard was properly not issued by the trial court. In Howard, this court said that where a jury cannot conscientiously reach a verdict, then a charge of the sort laid out in Howard would be appropriate. And in the instant case, the jury had received the case after phase two in the afternoon, and at 7:30 that night sent a note to the judge saying, we have taken four votes, we can't reach unanimous verdict. At that point, trial court notified counsel of the situation and offered a fair measure instruction that this is a short amount of time in a major case, in a complex case. We must not be discouraged, continue to deliberate. No one raised an objection to that proposed instruction by the trial court, and therefore, respectfully waived in there. And that instruction was offered, and the following day, the jury was ready with its unanimous verdict. It cannot be said then that this jury was deadlocked or conscientiously unable to reach a verdict for a long time. Turning to the last issue presented by the appellant, the aggravating circumstances in the instant case do outweigh mitigating factors. There are two separate bases for a position of the death penalty in this case. The first being the aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder of two or more persons. We have that in this case. Jimmy Dennis Armstrong sawed off shotgun, approached Dean Pizer in an alley behind an Akron bar, demanded money, told him not to run, that he was going to die tonight. You're going to die tonight. You're going to die tonight. Three separate times. And Dean Pizer had his wits about him, and he went running, and the sawed off shotgun was discharged as he ran away. That's your attempted aggravated murder. Moments later, the defendant comes upon Kurt Kyle and Marty Everhart, and he has a cohort, LeVar Anderson, with him. So it's the defendant and LeVar Anderson approaching Kurt Kyle and Marty Everhart. The defendant's cohort goes up to Marty Everhart. The defendant goes up to Kurt Kyle, presents a sawed-off shotgun within inches of him, and states, give me your money. There's the robbery. Kurt Kyle says, I don't have any money, furtively searches through his pockets, and Jimmy Dennis fires, killing Kurt Kyle. We have an attempted aggravated murder and an aggravated murder, and therefore there's a strong basis there, a legal statutory basis to impose a death penalty in that situation, and that is a proper aggravating circumstance for this court to consider.
Counsel, for me, first, this is where the Harris issue comes back into play, because you have a woman who was the victim of what, by legal standards, certainly is a violent offense. We don't really have enough details to know how violent it was or was not in a practical sense. Doesn't disclose it. In the middle of all this, the issues brought up, and she's the poor person. It seems to me that we need to safeguard the danger that this is a woman who is perhaps angry, angry at the system, angry at her father, angry that there's crime, angry that she's a victim. Now she's the poor person. You have a case that doesn't have a great deal of mitigating circumstances in terms of this youth's upbringing and his lack of parental care and his truancy, and maybe not in the nature of so much violent crime as a juvenile, but certainly a very troubled youth. And when you look at those scales, when I read the hearing of her testimony, she's so adamant that she can be fair and impartial. You can interpret that two ways. Obviously, I wasn't there to read the body language, but the written page is like almost like Shakespeare's, you protest too much. She's so adamant she can be absolutely fair, she can be absolutely impartial. This will in no way affect her. And somehow you almost read into that she desperately wants to stay on that jury. I'm troubled by that issue. How do we get into her mind to know what she was going to do? And isn't that the issue that we can't get into her mind?
Yes, Your Honor, and the state would respectfully assert two arguments in that regard. The first would be before Juror Harris was formally made a part of the jury and had become a poor person, considered any of the facts of the case, she conscientiously attempted to approach the court and ask, is my experience consistent with that question? Does that question encompass my experience? And I think that's a strong piece of evidence that suggests that Juror Harris was no zealot, she didn't have any special interest to be a juror. In fact, it shows quite the contrary, that she was conscientious in wanting to do her duties properly and answer the questions as they were asked. And the second, Your Honor, is that the two persons charged with defending this defendant, aware that he was facing the ultimate sentence, sat in on that individual voir dire, that being the defense attorney who began to administer, and were themselves convinced that this juror could continue because they didn't object. And that wasn't a mistake, because they did bring this juror to the attention of the trial court. They were poised to listen to the substance of her answers, yet they didn't object. And the reason they didn't object was it wasn't any kind of mistake, because they made a determination at that time that it was proper to allow her to stay on the jury. It was only at the conclusion of the trial, when the verdict went against the defense, that they sought at that time to revive and rehabilitate any imagined basis to assign legal error, and that represents the motion for mistrial.
I'm still concerned about that issue as well as Justice Stratton, because you've indicated that she approached the court. Now, maybe you're using that in the generic sense, but she never talked to the trial judge about this. She talked to the bailiff, didn't she?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so now we have the bailiff giving her a legal judgment on what is violence in a crime like this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not the court. All right, that's the first point. Second point is, why I was concerned about the transcript is because just while this all came up, Mr. Carroll says, Judge, well, I'd make it clear that this came to my attention, I think it was a week ago Sunday after we picked the jury, but before we started the evidence. And here's what bothers me. There was a note on my door in the office on Sunday evening from Fred Zutch, who is the chief of the criminal division of the prosecutor's office, concerning some potential problem with the juror. Now, obviously, if the state knew about this juror, the chief of the criminal division of the prosecutor's office was involved, they knew that she was a victim and not a witness, an alleged victim and not a witness. Why wouldn't that have been revealed to the other side?
Your Honor, when Prosecutor Carroll was aware that she was a victim, he immediately notified the defense counsel and the court was made aware of it. There was no delay, there was no play on the part of the state to somehow keep Juror Harris as part of this jury. During the guilt phase determination, phase one.
Wait a minute now, this is before any evidence was taken. Carroll knew it, had gotten a note from his chief of the criminal division, and then conveys that information. The next part of the transcript shows that Mrs. Harris was a witness in a child sex abuse case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Say anything about being a victim. why would the prosecutor want to really keep such a person on a jury if not that that person would be favorable to the state?
Your Honor, at that point, there was no telling whether that juror was going to be favorable or unfavorable to the state. The state sought to immediately disclose what information it had. We would not make a partial disclosure. There was, after all, sex abuse apparently allegedly committed against this juror's sisters. It was unclear at that point whether this juror, in fact, was a victim or not. That information that we had, there was no delay on the part of the state to ascertain the degree to which he was involved. It was immediately forwarded to defense counsel. Okay.
Did defense counsel make any effort that you're aware of to talk to the detective to find out what she was a witness of, how involved was she? I mean, he didn't ask any questions at the trial. We know that from the transcript. But is there any of the evidence that he went and did his own investigation to see what potential witness she was?
No, Your Honor, there's no indication of that.
Because the transcript just basically says both of us talked about it and decided it wasn't bothering with him, really, the importance that he gets the transcript. At least that's what they tell the trial judge in the hearing.
Yes, there was no indication that defense counsel would just be. Your Honor, another aggravating circumstance in the incident case is the fact that there's a felony murder that commits during the commission of the robbery. This defendant discharged his sawed-off shotgun and murdered her child. So there are two separate aggravating circumstances. Now, the mitigation evidence presented by the defendant's age, the defendant's upbringing, the state would suggest that upbringing has some seeds, perhaps not as strong mitigation evidence as the defense would hope. At the age of 15, this defendant was with a foster parent who apparently cared for the defendant quite a bit, said she loved him like a son, provided house rules for him to be in by 9 on weekdays and in by 11 on the weekends, attempted to make sure that he went to school. At the age of 15, he had someone who cared for him, he had someone who loved him, he had someone who encouraged him to go to school and do the right thing. He had someone that encouraged him to go to job for Indiana, and he did do that, and to pursue his GED. So while his childhood was not ideal, certainly, the state would not argue that it was. And when the Children's Service Board of Summit County came involved, was when his mother's utilities were turned off, and he went into foster care. So here was a foster parent, an important form of those years, that gave him a chance that he didn't accept. And the state would respectfully assert that that would constitute almost more of an aggravating circumstance than a mitigating circumstance. Certainly, from the age 15 and on, there are children and young people in worse conditions than the defendant. It's not a mitigating circumstance. For the foregoing reasons, they respectfully request that this court determine the most important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Merrick. Mr. Ray, you've saved a little over 5 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Your Honor, if I could very briefly respond to the statement made by the prosecutor. He indicated that by the age of 15, he went into a secure home environment with a foster parent. Therefore, from the age of 15 on, he should have been a good law-abiding citizen. However, as Dr. Brown testified for the mitigation phase of this hearing, he testified by the age of 15, a young person's manners in life were already developed. So to say that at 15 he had the ability to conform himself, I don't think it's a fair assessment to say that should be made with circumstances. I don't agree with that matter. I think by the age of 15, based upon his prior childhood, his pattern in life were already set. I think that is where the mitigation comes into this case.
You don't specifically raise it as an ineffective assistance to counsel, but could you certainly argue that failure to follow through with the Harris detective to find out about the witness, failure to ask questions about the witness, failure to object to Harris's hearing is an ineffective assistance to counsel? You don't raise that error, that assignment?
No, Your Honor, I did not raise that assignment in the process of 15. I think that this was properly preserved. I think that based upon the timing of this came in, It was a no-win situation because the end result was, hey, this is a mistrial, nothing later, and less. That was the only alternative they had to be able to do this.
But not at the beginning where they could have done some more thorough investigation on Harris before they picked the jury.
They knew that.
My understanding of the transcript is that if the jury had picked, if not about juror Harris, it became known to the prosecutor, informed the defense attorney, and it was never followed up at that point in time. What you're doing is shifting the burden over to the defense to say, well, we've already picked the jury, this juror never informed us.
Well, even if you raised an ineffective assistance of counsel, then you would certainly get in the area of looking at the evidence in this case and meeting the Strickland test, which would almost be impossible in this situation.
That's correct. It would be based on Strickland, it's almost impossible right there. Once again, it is a post-conviction issue that can be raised in post-conviction. But I think that in this case, it was raised improperly.
But counsel, you say there was a no-win situation. When they go back to the judge's chambers at that point, you already have a conviction, right?
Has 10 people out of
which you don't have penalty fares. How is that a no-win situation to ask for a mistrial at that point?
Well,
it seems to me that's a win, isn't it?
Let me rephrase that. The ultimate jury argument is dismissed. There was only one option for the court at this point in time. Either rehabilitate the jury for satisfaction or dismiss the jury, clear mistrial, and start over again. I don't think that's what the judge did.
Well, but that isn't before this. If you're a defense counsel, you don't sit there and try to please the judge, do you?
I guess we can look at everything in 2020 hindsight. We should have done this, we should have done that. I think that this court, I think that the court can find that it was properly made motion to mistrial in a timely fashion. I don't think this issue is waived for purposes of whether or not it could have been a better record.
So they knew about it before.
That's the way to see the knowledge that's available. In a lot of situations, I'm sure this quote is like she had before, a better record, but we don't have that here. All we can look at is look at what we have, the record in the case of the jury has been coming forward with evidence. She knew. She had disclosed it. She had an opportunity to disclose it to jury or up here, she simply didn't. She could have left, but she chose not to for some reason. And she knows why.
Okay, but the defendant's attorneys had something they also could have done, and that is moved for mistrial before they went on into the sentencing phase.
Didn't know it.
I guess I'm not sure what point in time you're talking about, but they didn't find out she was a victim until they were in the penalty deliberations. And I guess up until that point in time, whether her being a witness was concerned or not, I'm not sure. The fact that she was a victim, that she was going to sign a complaint, and she was still a person of the jury, the fact that she had two sisters that were signed a complaint with her, all these factors came into play for the defense counsel. At that point in time, they requested a mistrial. I think that they properly deserved the record in this case. Your Honor, based upon that, we request the decision to be the detailed company's penalty in this case be reversed. Also, the commission be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.